Accession number 10923, reel 8.
Mr. Harold Harper, reel 8. We were talking about your time in Tobruk, and the one thing you've mentioned a couple of times is flash spotting when you were on OP work. What did that involve, and how did you go about
this? This involved taking angles to the guns, to the German guns, obviously to the flashes, reporting them back to regimental headquarters, who got a survey team, a specialist survey team for that type of thing. And they would then plot in, having got our coordinates for the observation post, they would then do what they call cross coordinates, because the same flash would probably be spotted, because we had to report the time, and they would get a cross fire, so to speak, from another observation post and be able to link the two together, or even three, and wherever that point crossed would be the actual position of the gun.
Was this effective?
Yes, I think so, because they seemed to quiet them down anyway after when we were eventually ordered to fire on these things. Mind you, the Germans had got the advantage, of course. They could move about more than we could. We were pretty well sitting ducks, but because we hadn't got the space to move around, they could dash in and dash out and do all sorts of things.
Did you have any problems with small arms fire while you were?
No. So none at all. That was nothing. Never. I never had any problems with small arms fire.
So we weren't under that sniping or
no,
anything.
No.
So the sniping was done with the artillery, so to speak.
That's right, yeah.
Now, while you were there, you were cooperating throughout the first phase, at least, with the 1st Royal Horse Artillery.
That's right.
How did that work? What was the system? I mean, it's not usual for batteries to be working together like that, is it?
No, they were just on our flank, actually. And when you say cooperating, I mean, we were all sort of engaged in the same sort of actions. That's the important thing.
So, it didn't seem...
But they obviously were a very mature battery with a lot of expertise. And I think we learned from them. And learned very quickly.
What sort of expertise were they passing on? I mean, what tips were they giving you, sir?
General tactics. It's very difficult to remember, quite frankly, but it was a sort of general attitude to the whole business of fighting, whereas they've been very much involved prior to that.
So it was their example?
Their example, I think, was, yes. I'm sorry I hesitated there, but it was difficult to sort of put it in words, but you felt there was an aura of authority with the 1st RHA, and the fact that we knew we were alongside one of the crack regiments of the British Army. I mean, they were never slow to remind us that they were a crack regiment.
How would they? Was that cause friction, or was it?
No. I think in all fairness, it was admiration more than anything.
How you say you learned quickly? Do you think you gained the level of efficiency that they had while you were at Tobruk?
I would think by the end of Tobruk, we were as efficient as they were, and I think they would be the first to admit it.
Yeah. So it was recognised.
Yes. I think the the regular soldiers definitely, whereas they were treated as in the early days as weekend soldiers. I think they came down to the fact that eventually that we were up to their up to scratch, so to speak.
While you were there, were you involved at all in the practice of taking one gun forward, almost to the wire, for artillery work? I mean, did you know anything about that?
Yes, I did that.
What was it? Could you explain what happened?
It's very vague, but we had. Occasionally, we'd take a gun forward with the idea of trying to reach the Engladham Road. That was the idea. because we knew we couldn't reach from our rear gun positions. And what we had to do then was to go forward, fire, get into position, and I had to put them in position. Then they'd fire 20 or 30 rounds very, very quickly, and then get back quickly, quite frankly.
Would there be a pre-prepared gun
program?
Pit?
Yes.
Gun pit. Would
yes, that's right. We would go up, and I would go first and get everything established.
What does that mean? Tell me how you did it.
Take the director and put them onto a certain line, which was approved, and then have all that set up, and then when the gun came in, literally, it was a question of there, that's it. We were talking in terms of a couple of minutes, rather than any other great length.
So there'd
of
be
time.
No gun pit at all?
No. And then they'd fire away, and, as I say, then hop it fairly quickly.
How long would it take them to fire these 20 or 30 rounds?
Probably about 5 minutes.
So a couple of minutes to set to get the gun in.
That's
after
right.
You'd set up
the whole thing from start to finish, to taking the gun out of the pit at the other end and getting it back in again, would be about just over an hour.
Did you find that was that interesting, that particular sort of
oh yes, it was something, because we there again we felt we were doing something. Okay, we're putting ourselves at some risk, but we felt that we were doing something to try and hamper the Germans.
When you set your line, and you did you have a programme, these 20 or 30
That's
shots?
Right, the programmes were worked out before the guns got up there.
And what would the programme be like?
It would be to spray over a wide area.
So you'd be giving them fire at one shot and then...
That's right, yeah. And then this was at the time when we knew there was a lot of movement going down towards the front. Down to Saloon, you see. Well, this was an everyday movement, you see. So
you wouldn't know whether you'd hit anything then, would
no.
you?
No. Occasionally we would see the odd smoke going up, which would, we'd say, OK, we've done this, but whether it was us or not, or somebody else, I don't honestly know.
How often did this exercise take place?
Oh, only probably about 3 or 4 times during the whole of the Siege of Tobruk.
Do you remember any other specific operations while you were there? I mean, events?
Gosh.
They set up an observation post in an Arab village, Bir al-Aziz.
No, I wasn't involved in that. That was on the western flank of Tobruk. We were more on the southeast. Mm.
So, any other aspects of your time at Tobruk?
No.
Any
no,
stories that might give us
no,
an idea?
No, other, no other stories, quite frankly, until with the breakout from Tobruk, which came in November.
Well, could you tell me about the preparations for that then? Preparations were made?
There again, we had a lot of preparations to make there, because we knew exactly which positions we were going to take. And there was a lot of calculating and working out to do there. We were going to an area called Tiger, which was the code name, which was only just within the guns were going to be moved up almost to the perimeter. And they were going, the idea was to keep as many of the German forces at bay whilst our armies were pushing up from Saloon, and the idea was to they would relieve us eventually. But of course,
so your role would be in preparing
my role was in preparing the program, and also of course we had to move up through the minefield gap during the night, which was a bit hazardous. But nevertheless, we'd put tapes down to make sure that we were getting through. And then we had to dig ourselves in very quickly.
Who put the tapes down? Was that your job to work out
no,
the gap? Or?
No, that was put down by the engineers, in all fairness. they lifted several mines and made a little gap for us, about as wide as this room, that's all.
So you dug in quickly?
Very, very quickly.
In Now, this is a... When you're in a sort of big operation like this, and a gun program was being prepared... Now, you were at the Don Troop command post, and then you'd have a survey team at the battery post, and then would there be a survey team at the regimental?
Yes.
Yeah. How did these three teams interconnect, if you see what I mean? Who would decide... I mean, the regimental, who would they tell?
Regimental would tell the batteries exactly where their batteries were to cover. The batteries would tell each troop the area they had to cover. Then it was left to the troop to work it out exactly what we were covering. Yeah, and our job at grassroots was to tell each gun, thou wilt fire on this elevation and this angle.
That's very clear. So what happened then? Anything? Can you take us through that operation? Because it went on for quite a while.
It went on much longer than we expected, because the troops from the coming up from the saloon hit problems at a place called Sidi Rizik, where there was a huge tank battle, and we found ourselves, instead of being relieved, we found ourselves on the receiving end of terrific barrages, so much so that we had to move out of our position. And we had to move out very, very quickly.
How would you do that? I mean, moving out in the last...
We had to move out in the middle of the afternoon. I was in the command post. This story, I'm sure, will be quite acceptable. It is amusing, really. I was in the command post, but we had to move in a hurry. The battery commander came, and the battery commander at the time was Gary Birkin. He said, well, I'm doing my best for you. He said, but you'll still be under observation from the enemy. We were in full observation from the enemy. That's why we were getting well and truly hammered. But then, of course, we'd done a fair amount of damage, I would imagine, in the early stages, until they cottoned on to where we were. And then they really let us have it then. And so we moved out late afternoon. And we'd had a fair number of casualties then. And I helped the guns. And threw the artillery board and everything onto, and we moved to this position, which was about 500 or 600 yards to the right. So, in other words, we didn't move, and slightly right rear. And it wasn't until we reached there that I found that I'd left the director stand about 200 yards behind the guns, and my officer, Captain Birkin, was not pleased. Although he and I were the very best of friends, he was not pleased, and he said, you'll go and get it as soon as it's dusk. So dusk arrived about 2 hours later, and I walked across this no man's land, if you might like to call it, and I just got there, and it was sort of, the dusk was descending, and the Germans, obviously, having had some success by hitting this position, did exactly what we would have done in this circumstance. They would have had their guns on this particular line and elevation, ready to fire in case they saw any more movement. And somebody must have spotted me walking across, and suddenly, of course, they let fly. So I got these all to myself, and I dived for the very first trench I could find, and that first trench I found was the troop latrine. And I finished up with ankle deep in it. So, I mean, that's a story that will probably go down. Nobody wanted to speak to me for about 2 or 3 days after that, but nevertheless I managed eventually to clean myself up. But that's one little side story. But
what was it like under a heavy bombardment? Like you'd had the day before, you know, that before you moved. Can you describe what it was like? What would the guns carry on fire?
Yes. Yeah. Whenever we were under bombardment like that, we always did our best to make sure that the guns kept firing, because it was. If I may go back to the dive bombing. After we were dive bombed and the air had cleared, only a matter of about 2 or 3 minutes after the last plane had gone, our officer ordered 2 rounds of gunfire onto a registered target. Anything to relieve the situation and to give the men the feeling that they were hitting back. And this was one of the things we during a bombardment, invariably, we would keep the guns firing.
Wouldn't it have been safer for the gun crews
to have stopped down?
To have stepped down into the trenches?
Yes, but they were, in all fairness, there was probably a necessity to keep firing. I don't think we were firing sort of just because for the sake of it, but invariably we would keep them firing as long as we could.
Would you be firing on the batteries that were firing at you?
Well, no, not necessarily. We would be firing at some other target. It was some very heroic deeds. One would find it. I mean, our troop sergeant major now, I can see him. He, during the barrage, he would be walking behind the guns, ducking every 10 seconds and shouting out words of encouragement, you know, and that was all that was necessary, really.
Would you be out in the open during such a bombardment?
No, not necessarily, because I would be committed to the command post to make sure there was any instructions to be passed on. It was during this breakout from Tobruk that I experienced a very personal loss, in as much as the padre came to me one day to tell me my mother had died. And this, at a time when everything seemed to be going against us, was a blow indeed. My mother was only 41, so that was quite young.
What else do you remember about the breakout? This went on for a while. Did they find the second position?
Yes. We just moved to this alternative position, and the battle ebbed and flowed for days, and until suddenly we did establish the breakthrough.
Were you aware of what was happening?
Yes, very much so. We by then we really knew. We had been told what was happening. We knew that almost to the man exactly what we were expected to do. And
was this the first time you'd been briefed like that?
Well, in all fairness, this was the first real battle that we had been. And don't forget, this was the first time we decided that we were the people who were doing the attacking.
How was the briefing conducted? Because they couldn't get you all together at once.
No, in all fairness, the briefing was conducted to the officers, and then the officers would call groups together, probably the numbers ones from the guns, and they would tell them to go back to the guns and tell them exactly what was happening.
So you were aware of...
We were fully aware of what was wanted of us for that breakout.
And you think that helped?
Oh, yes, yes. As I say, it was the first time we were on the attack. I mean, you can't really tell people when you're defending.
What happened next, then? I mean...
Eventually, when we linked up with the advancing troops, obviously they were in far better nick than we were, and all we did was to follow them up to about... 40 or 50 miles farther up past Tobruk, by which time I had got yellow jaundice.
What were the symptoms of that? I mean, how badly did you get it?
Just couldn't fancy anything to eat whatsoever. Stomach felt shocking. Sick all the time. I was evacuated eventually to Tobruk Hospital just before Christmas. Spent Christmas Day on the hospital ship, along with a lot of New Zealanders and Australians and what have you, who were all being evacuated from Tobruk Hospital.
Now, that's one thing I missed out. You mentioned earlier you started getting a touch of dysentery at Tobruk. How was that prevalent at Tobruk?
It came in batches, really. I had dysentery, but not quite as bad as some poor devils. I mean, I can recall one very, very strong sergeant major one morning crawling from his dugout on his hands and knees, trying to get to the troop latrine, and leaving a trail behind him all the way, which was pretty pathetic, I'm afraid. He was taken away, and we never saw him again for about 6 months. But he recovered, yeah. I do believe in 425 Battery, they had a laddie who, before the war, was so athletic, he'd had a trial with Derby County at football, and Derby County, as you probably may have been aware, were a top-class team before the Second World War. He'd played for their reserves, and this lad actually died of dysentery in Tobruk. So it meant fitness meant nothing when it came to things like dysentery.
Now, you'd got jaundice. Was that prevalent as well?
Yes, very prevalent indeed. This was caused by... They did say that one of the causes of that was eating too much bully beef. And lack of certain things in the diet. When I eventually got down to a hospital in the Delta, I was fed on jellies. Anything that was very, very appetising. Jellies and chicken. But it took a long time to eat anything solid.
While you were at Tobruk, had you had any vitamin supplements?
No.
So you still...
Still hadn't done any vitamin supplements.
How long did it take you? You went to Tobruk Hospital and then back to the Delta.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Which hospital did you go to there?
42nd General, which was a tent of hospital, of course.
And were you satisfied with the medical treatment you got?
Oh, yes. Yes. It was out of this world, really, because you've never been used to having nice white sheets to sleep in and things like this, you see.
Had you picked up lice at all at Tobruk?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But...
Were they a big problem?
Yes. In as much as... if you've got a hairy body, as I had at the time, they seem to nestle down in the hairs and became a bit of a nuisance. But
was it just the itching, or did they lead to sores?
The itching more than anything. Yeah, yeah.
Did you have any method of trying to stop them?
Used to spray ourselves with some sort of. I'll rub some sort of ointment into us. I think we used to go to the doc, the old medical, and he used to give you some blue ointment or something. He used to dry them off. Yeah.
So how long were you in the 42nd General?
Oh, only about a week. Then I was transferred to a convalescent depot.
Where was that?
Just near the hospital, in the Delta area.
And how long was it before you rejoined 107?
Oh, about 3 weeks altogether, that's all.
Were you worried you might not get back to them?
No. No, I was never worried about that at that stage, because the war was pretty well running in our way, so to speak, so there was And I knew that our regiment was being brought back into the Delta area.
So you got back to them...
At a place called Beni Yusuf, which was outside Cairo.
And that would be in January, I suppose.
That would be probably, yes, about the third week in January, something like that.
Now, what was happening to the regiment there? Were you brought up to strength? Did you get any drafts?
No, we had a complete transformation in Beni Yusuf because we were made into a three-battery regiment. In other words, we had 4-2-5 battery, 4-2-6 and 5-2-0. And this was, we looked upon this as a great honour because we thought, well, they must have thought we did a good job in Tobruk to make us up into a three-battery regiment.
Where were the men to come for this?
Recruits. What happened was the 4-2-5 battery lost B troop to 5-2-0, and 4-2-6 battery lost D troop.
Your old troop.
My troop to 5-2-0. So 5-2-0 battery under Major Gary Birkin was probably the most established battery of the three because the other two had to make up from recruits which were pouring into the Middle East at the time.
Now, these recruits that came in, I know you went to 5-2-0 battery,
right.
I know, but the recruits that came in, were they from Nottingham?
No. No, they were from anywhere, quite frankly.
Did this change the character
To a certain extent, yes.
Was it?
But by the same rule, even before then, we noticed that the Nottingham content was not as high as it was. Because when we'd been made up to full strength just before Christmas, when we moved away abroad, we had a number of conscript lads joined us from all over the country.
Did you mind that they weren't from Nottingham?
No, we got on very well.
Did they fitted in well then?
Yes, they fitted in quite well. They occasionally would make some comment about Nottingham Castle and all the what have you, but I think they were quite happy.
I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about some of the main characters of the battery. What do you remember about the regimental commander? Do you remember him at all?
Colonel Seely, yes. Always gave me the impression in my position that he was a very efficient chap. Always there in the thick of the action. It was always good to see the colonel come round. He visited us on a number of occasions in Tobruk. He was certainly there at the breakout. And that always instilled a lot of confidence into the men.
Was he popular then?
Bill Seely was quite popular, yes. And of course everybody knew him as living in Ramsgate Park near Nottingham.
What about the Birkin brothers?
The Birkin brothers?
They weren't brothers, were they? No, they
were Birkin brothers. There was Ivor Birkin and Gary Birkin and Peter Birkin. Peter was the cousin. Oh, yes, they were very acceptable. Yes, particularly Gary Birkin, who was possibly the most efficient officer.
Was he the one you were linked with?
I was linked with Gary Birkin, yeah.
What kind of a man was he?
Very human. He was there when the padre told me my mother had died. And Gary Birkin, that particular evening outside Tobruk, I think he was really marvellous. I mean, on reflection, I made a mistake on the director, and he just patted me on the back. And he said, "It's the first mistake I've ever seen you make," he said. And so I thought, fair enough. So, I mean, there was a very human character about him. Yeah.
Any other officers you remember?
Oh, yes, I remember pretty well all of them. Bob Hingston.
What was he like?
He was very, very good indeed, yes. Extremely good. Ivor Birkin, of course, was the GPO, and I got on with Ivor very... The gun position officer. He got on with Ivor very well indeed. In fact, I was with Ivor in later days at the Battle of Knightsbridge, which we'll obviously be coming to later.